Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hey everyone, it's 2020, the new year, the perfect time to choose what your New Year's resolution is going to be. And for us, it'd be perfect if your New Year's resolution was to subscribe, rate, and review The Alarmist. Now, we've had some great feedback recently. This is one from someone called Princess Clark, and she writes, "Alarmist, a must listen, 5 stars. The combination of history plus comedy plus anxiety is perfect. Love Rebecca, Amanda, Chris, and all the guests. Get on there and give us that 5-star review and say something nice and tell your friends. Thanks for listening."
An Erio's original.
I was born with a special gift. The ability to mentally transform any situation into the worst case scenario. In my own brain. My therapist calls my gift catastrophizing. And that's why I'm uniquely qualified to scrutinize and analyze history's greatest disasters and find out who's to blame. They say history repeats itself. Not on my watch. My name is Rebecca Delgado Smith, and I am The Alarmist.
Hey everyone, thanks for tuning into The Alarmist, a comedy podcast where we take history's greatest disasters and tragedies and figure out who's to blame. Today we'll be discussing the Lindbergh baby kidnapping. Ay, ay, ay. Here we go. Charles Lindbergh Jr. was 20 months old when he was stolen from his crib in East Amwell, New Jersey. The son of pilot Charles Lindbergh, who was made famous by completing the first nonstop flight from New York to Paris, and Anne Morrow Lindbergh. His kidnapping grabbed the attention of the world.
Everybody's talking about the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. Who do you think's to blame?
The evening of March 1st, 1932 was a wet one. Charles and Anne were in the first floor library of their rural home as Charles Jr. slept soundly in his upstairs nursery. Later in the night, his nurse, Betty Gow, went to check on the child and realized he was missing. She alerted Charles, who went into the baby's room only to find a ransom note asking for $50,000, a chisel, footprints, and a homemade ladder. After 2 more ransom notes were sent, a retired teacher named John Condon offered to be the mediator between the kidnappers and the Lindberghs. He corresponded with the kidnapper through the newspaper and arranged to meet in person at a cemetery to exchange the $50,000 ransom for the location of Charles Jr. Lindbergh himself, along with investigators, traveled to the given location, but the baby was nowhere to be found. The Lindberghs' greatest fears came true when on May 12, 1932, the decomposed body of Charles Lindbergh Jr. was found. Fractures in the skull, along with the evidence of the broken rung on the homemade ladder found at the crime scene, suggested that the kidnapper had fallen and that the baby had been dead since the night he was kidnapped.
Despite the greatest manhunt in history, the baby's murder was not discovered until his little body was found here in the woods near his home 2 months later.
Fun facts, aka death stats. The details of the case are strange, starting with the scene of the kidnapping. The footprints proved inconclusive, and no fingerprints were found at the scene. The Lindberghs claimed to have heard no commotion from the downstairs library. The ransom note was also highly unusual. It contained many misspellings along with its demands. It reads,
"Dear sir, have $50,000 ready, $25,000 in $20 bills, $15,000 in $10 bills, and $10,000 in $5 bills. After 2 to 4 days, we will inform you where to deliver the money. We warn you for making anything public or for notify the police. The child is in good care. Indication for all letters are signature and 3 holes.
At the bottom of the note were 2 interconnected blue circles surrounding a red circle, with a hole punched through the red circle and 2 more holes to the left and right. The remains were discovered by a truck driver in a grove of trees near a road just 4.5 miles south of the Lindbergh house. Today, the $5,000 ransom is equivalent to about $1.3 million. In September of 1934, investigators traced some of the ransom money paid to the kidnapper to a German man named Bruno Richard Hauptmann. More circumstantial evidence led to his conviction and ultimate execution. He maintained his innocence until his death by electric chair on April 3, 1936. Many speculate he was wrongly accused. Instead, theories abound that he may have had many accomplices or that the kidnapping was an inside job.
His abduction from his Hopewell home was a challenge to America. This ladder, the only clue to the kidnapping, was homemade. And much is made of the fact that Hauptmann is a carpenter and could easily have built one similar to this. Let the developments in the Lindbergh baby case start a new drive to wipe out the stain. Not only of that wanton kidnapping and murder, but of all kidnapping and crime. Let the justice dealt for this baby's abduction serve notice. America demands death for all kidnappers and murderers. Do you think your husband is guilty of kidnapping the Lindbergh baby?
I'm absolutely sure my husband had nothing to do with the Lindbergh kidnapping case.
Well, today we have a very special guest with us. A returning guest, actually. You might remember her from the Great Molasses Flood of Boston episode, Maggie Marion.
Oh my gosh, it's me again.
It really is. And just so our listeners know, we also have with us producer Maria.
Hey guys.
And
Ave.
Fact checker.
What are you going to say about me?
And fact checker, Chris Smith.
What's up, guys?
Nice teeth.
There, you can't tell, but I have nice teeth and nice hair. I'm having a good hair day.
Yeah.
I didn't shower today.
That'll do it.
That'll do it. Maggie, tell us what you know about the Lindbergh baby kidnapping.
Well, I know a decent amount because one fateful brunch, my husband Adam and I, we just started talking about it. I'd come across a reference to the Lindbergh baby, mm-hmm. the crime of the century. Oh, you know what it was? Uh-huh. I was listening to Ragtime, the musical. And it starts off with the crime of this calling, the Evelyn Nesbit murder, involving Evelyn Nesbit's lover as the crime of the century, but it was the beginning of the century. And so I was looking up other crimes of the century, and this is one of them, along with the OJ case. And so we didn't know about it, and so we started reading all about it, and we just spent the whole day kind of immersed in it because there's so many fascinating details.
So many twists and turns.
But so my knowledge consists of one day a few years ago of reading about it.
You did a bunch of
research.
It's
probably more than a lot of people.
Yeah.
Well, I was realizing that no one taught me this in school. No one talked about the Lindbergh baby in school.
No.
We should have. It's a huge trial.
Yeah. Well, so. We've got a Nazi sympathizer kind of
exactly.
in the center. So
you think that they didn't want to bring it up because of the Nazi ties?
Yeah.
Really quickly, though, Rebecca, just before you get into like the kidnapping part of it, who were the Lindberghs? Like, what?
Good question.
Great question.
And why would this baby be kidnapped?
So Lindbergh himself, in 1925, goes across the Atlantic on a plane by himself. From New
first
York
guy.
To Paris. And he's the first one to ever do this. It's
solo
a 33-hour trip. He does it by himself. I believe seven people have attempted to do this before him. Three of them die trying to do it. And there's apparently this prize even. There's a...
$25,000.
Yeah, to actually finish the trip. Mm-hmm. And he does it. So
it made
he
him
becomes,
rich and famous.
He's
right?
like this hero in America. And like I was...
Well, then he married an heiress.
Well, that's what happens afterward in 1927 is he's become rich and he gets paid like something like $2,500 a week to go make these speeches. Mm. At these universities, and also he wrote an autobiography at the age of, I think it was 25 when he crosses. Maybe Chris can double check that, but at a very young age.
A mere whippersnapper.
He's like already doing an autobiography of himself. He's like, oh, okay. Anyway, he is so famous. He's like above Beyonce. He is he is so famous at the time.
Right.
He was 25 when he crossed the Atlantic.
He was 25. So
good looking.
20
doesn't hurt.
No, he was very
he
handsome.
He was also
and
having
tall,
a good air day. Yeah.
And he meets this woman, Anne, and she's the daughter of a JP Morgan, it's his financial advisor, essentially.
The Murrows.
Yes. And she's very rich. And in the autobiography, he says that the ideal relationship is with a woman who is smart and has good genes. It's a bit of like telling, you know, even in his statement about what his ideal wife, it's like he is a well-known eugenicist. Is that what you call it?
Yeah.
Someone
I don't know if that's what you call a singular
eugenist.
Person, but he was into eugenics.
He was into eugenics. He was a eugenist.
He was into eugenics. He was a shithead.
Yeah. Right.
For those of you who don't know what eugenics is, Maggie, maybe you can tell them.
Eugenics is
you'll
just
be better at that.
The theory that you can breed a perfect human.
Yeah.
And that you can just that breeding humans to achieve human perfection
exactly.
is the right way to go.
Yes.
And you know that's what the Nazis were into.
Exactly.
Among other people.
It was a popular thing at the time.
Yes, there was a kind of human. This was like human potential movement of like the 70s and 80s. This was sort of like human potential movement like 1.0.
So Charles Lindbergh, just to sort of summarize back to what Maria was asking, is this hugely successful and powerful and now rich guy, super famous. Everyone knows him. Probably on, you know, page six or whatever the
page
equivalent.
Page six.
Of.
I mean, he is all over.
Back then, there was only four pages, and he was on every one.
So the kidnapping happens, and there's this ransom note, and they're told to wait, have this money ready in the ransom note. We're going to contact you. Mm-hmm. What happens is that they use the newspaper to try and communicate with.
The kidnappers.
These kidnappers. And John Condon is a 71-year-old semi-retired Bronx school teacher who writes into a local Bronx paper and offers to act as this intermediary for the Lindberghs and the kidnappers. So this guy even offers like $1,000 of his own money to add to the, you know,
pot.
And according to the New York Press, Condon was known as a blustery neighborhood character that no one took seriously, except for some reason, the Lindberghs and the kidnappers. So the kidnappers are like, yeah, that guy's good enough.
It's and so strange.
It's
so
it's weird. Very weird.
It's so weird.
And
so
weird.
They decide to meet at this cemetery, and right. that's why it's called Cemetery John. So he goes to the cemetery. He gets told where to, through another
Condon.
Letter. Condon gets sent a letter from the kidnappers. Mm-hmm. So the way they would communicate is Condon or the Lindberghs would put something up on the newspaper, and then the they would receive a letter from the kidnappers. Finally, Condon gets told to meet Cemetery John, this guy who was, according to John Condon, German or had a German accent and wore a fedora hat.
Ooh, what a cool guy. Slick guy.
I kept reading that and I was like, is that of the time or was that a choice?
Like particularly yeah. unique. You'll know him by his fedora hat.
Anyway, he's like, okay, bring me the ransom money. And Condon gives him the ransom money. And FBI, or someone in the FBI.
The head of the FBI at the time was Hoover.
Hoover, that's right.
Hubert.
So Hoover. They get this great idea. It wasn't Hoover who had this idea, but someone involved in the case has this great idea that they should do gold certificates.
Right.
They should pay it in gold certificates because in 1935, a year later, they're going to do away with these gold certificates. So
trace
it would
the bills.
Exactly. And it would be very odd for anyone right. to be using gold certificates.
They thought that doing that, then it would be easily traceable, but they thought that the kidnappers would go for that?
Well,
they did.
Well, and that's what was okay. genius about that. So this money gets given to the kidnappers. And of course, sadly, they receive the information of where the child is supposed to be. It's supposedly on a boat in Martha's Vineyard. Of course, the child is not there. And eventually, we find the child's body a few months later, and we all know what happens there. But what happens with these gold certificates, the kidnapper, or we're assuming whoever they are.
Bruno, Richard.
They keep getting used. And all of a sudden, the banks start having a trail of this kidnapper's money or where it's being used. And that's how they find Bruno. So in September 19, 1934, Bruno is arrested and a $20 gold certificate from the ransom payment was found in his person. And the reason that he's arrested is because he used another gold certificate, I believe at a gas station, and the gas attendant thought he was a little sketchy and perhaps that might have been a fake gold certificate. And so he writes the license plate on the gold certificate. And that's how he gets found. The case against Hampton mounts quickly. And the day after his arrest, more than 13,000 in gold ransom certificates are discovered in Hampton's garage. I'm sorry, I keep saying Hampton, but it's Hauptmann's. So,
German guy.
It's a German guy, which is interesting because the letter, it has some misspellings that
are consistent with
German like speaking. German. So, for instance, the child is in gut care, G-U-T. So a lot of people were like, oh, it must be a German immigrant. First of all, I think we need to put Bruno up on the board.
Let's
I feel like that's...
What's his last name again? Humpton?
Humper.
It's H-A-U-P-T-M-A-N-N. He is later identified by Condon, the guy, as the John, as the John that he meets in the cemetery.
Right.
And handwriting analysis found that Hauptmann's penmanship was stylistically consistent with the ransom notes that were sent by the kidnapper. So this guy, though, he has a prior criminal record.
Yeah, not a good guy.
He's not a great guy.
No.
It included burglary. It was back in Germany.
He held a pregnant lady or a lady with a child up in yes. at gunpoint in broad daylight.
Yeah.
Not a good guy.
He's got a history. And so it was a bit of an obvious choice.
And there was some evidence that this ladder, there was this special ladder or yes. this unique ladder that
homemade ladder
was found that was found that can was made of wood that was in his attic as well.
Right. So he was a carpenter. Seems, yeah. They were able to like trace the wood that seems was like used for the yeah. He definitely seemed involved. Now whether he was the only person,
agreed.
That
seems off.
And also I mean he says he claimed that it was his friend Isidore Fish. Who
sounds like a name from Harry Potter. Isidore Fish does it's a
so Isidore Fish. He is a German friend of Bruno's.
Okay.
Isidore Fish, he goes back to Germany and he's very ill and he dies. There's a ton of circumstantial evidence that gets thrown at Bruno. None of it the biggest forensic, if you could call it even that, it's not even is the wood.
It's the wood.
Exactly. So that supposedly it gets tracked to wood he purchased himself.
I think it was part of his home.
There was a part of it that was his home. Oh. And also they found Condon's phone number in his closet.
However,
in his closet.
Did you read this?
No.
That a
I can already tell no.
That a reporter
yes
admitted to writing it there.
No.
Instead later. Yes. And in fact, it was a newspaper that a newspaper financially backed his defense in exchange for getting an exclusive interview with him.
Oh, and the wife. They paid the wife.
And after this
Hearst.
Case...
Hearst. Of course.
And after this case, there was a law that says that said that a newspaper couldn't get involved in financially in criminal cases.
The 1920s and 30s were an incredible time.
It was
time.
A shit show. It was just like, fucking see insane. What you can get away with.
Okay, so it's interesting you say that because that's circumstantial evidence, what you said about the reporter.
Yeah.
Right. And of course, it's like anyone can write a phone number.
Sure.
In a closet, just get there before the police do. Sure. To take a picture.
And or be a police there. Be a crooked policeman.
It's right. Very sketchy.
Yeah.
Anyway, the hardest evidence is this piece of wood that matches perfectly.
Literally.
Yeah.
Knock on wood.
I'm just going to say this, that if you didn't get away with a murder before DNA testing...
You're dumb.
You're an idiot.
You're dumb.
Like, it doesn't make sense to me. They had nothing to go on.
Exactly.
I don't like the cut of his jib.
He tried to explain that he had given the money. He was given the money by this deceased guy,
Isidore Fish,
and he had been hoarding the gold certificates based on his experience living in Germany after World War I. This is according to history.com. I'm afraid of inflation, he told police. This was his... But fair enough.
He was also defense.
Yeah. I know what inflation was in Germany, and I wasn't taking any chances. Neighbors had noticed that Hauptmann had suddenly stopped working in 1932, and he told them that he was making money on Wall Street, although few were doing that because it's the Great Depression.
This guy, we have all the circumstantial and we have some of the hard evidence in the terms of the wood. I mean, like, can we move on from Bruno? And
I think you're right. Yeah. I think I want to put Isidore Fish too, because he's not without he could have definitely been an accomplice. So Isidore, a little backstory on him.
Okay.
According to Wikipedia, Fish was a well-known in the German-American community of the Bronx as a strange character. Mm. He had approached many of the community to invest in a variety of business schemes, most of which were bogus. He was also involved in some small fencing operations, which included the purchasing of hot, quote-unquote, hot money cheaply to store and reuse later.
These sound like Martin Scorsese characters.
Yeah. Fish and Hauptmann met in 1932, became friends, and agreed to pool the risks and profits of Fish's trade in furs. So he was also a fur trader. And Hauptmann's stock investment. Fish applied for a passport on the May 12th, 1932, the same day that the Lindbergh baby was found dead.
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
So that is fishy.
Fishy. It is fishy.
That's where that saying comes from, actually.
Yeah.
You have those friends who are always pitching you ideas like, what if we did this? Or like, you know, especially with the prevalence of Shark Tank and all that. Mm-hmm. Like these guys would be at Shark Tank probably every year with a new idea, Fish and Hopman. So it makes you wonder if the idea to kidnap the Lindbergh baby was a brainchild of their both combined efforts.
Well, it's possible. Regardless, they weren't very good at what they did because Fish then returns to Germany in March of 1934, and he dies of tuberculosis. I'm sorry, he returned before March of 1934. On that day, in that month, he dies of tuberculosis, and he dies a pauper because he only took back $600 with him when he went back to Germany. And so that was part of the argument, saying he couldn't have done it because if he had done it, then he would have had more money and he wouldn't have died in such dire circumstances. He would have been able to afford the medical care that he needed back in Germany.
Okay, but I mean, he's a bad businessman. Who knows
exactly
what he got into between, you know, between New York or New Jersey and Frankfurt or wherever he was.
Right. And he could have thought, you know, I got the $600. I'm probably going to turn it into $1,200.
Right.
And kick this TV. That's right.
But
Germany.
Why would you leave, I don't know, the other...
All that money,
you know,
behind?
In a shoebox, supposedly, in Hauptmann's attic.
Well, when that thing... when the story blew up, they probably didn't want to be carrying too much money.
Right.
It's like that scene in Goodfellas when
that is true.
De Niro yells at everybody for buying stuff after their big Lufthansa heist.
Remember that?
And then Hauptmann then, once Isidore is gone, that's when he starts spending. So it's sketch.
Super, super sketch. Also, how did they know that what window to go in? How did they know that they were going to be there? The Lindberghs didn't even stay at that house.
No,
they were in very often. Most of the week they spent
in New York City.
In New York City,
and they were actually supposed to be in New York City.
Right. So how did they know?
Some people think it could have been an insider job.
Something. It definitely wasn't just like this one dumb Hauptmann. Baby's in good care. It's definitely not him.
I'm with you. That's what I'm trying to tell you guys.
So let's put some other people on the board because I want to put the dad.
Uh-oh.
Charles Lindbergh.
Charles Lindbergh himself.
Chucky's going up there, huh?
Yeah. So he's a hero, but he's
asterisk.
Not as squeaky clean as we think he is, obviously. So he becomes a national villain much after the case because of his, Nazi sympathizing ways. A summary of a theory from a Rutgers historian, definitely on the conspiracy theory end. Lloyd C. Gardner, professor of history emeritus, points to Lindbergh's fascination with social Darwinism and evidence
eugenics.
That health problems plaguing his 20-month-old son, Charles Lindbergh Jr., suggested the child was far from perfect. Lindbergh adhered to the growing Scandinavian-German notion of the 1930s about the racial superiority of Northern Europeans compared to Southern Europeans and Asians. And what we know about Lindbergh's character, Gardner says, is that his desire to spread his healthy genes and his belief in the eugenics movement, which goes hand-in-hand with the pro-German feelings about the war, he also had secret affairs starting in 1957 with three women in Germany, two of them sisters, which led to seven children besides the six that he already had with his wife, are reminiscent of an experiment. So this is this guy Gardner saying that he thought he was experimenting.
With making a perfect baby.
Yes.
Right.
And the child apparently appeared to have been afflicted with rickets.
This is Charles.
This is what...
Charles Jr.
Which is affects the development of strong bones.
It's a vitamin disorder.
He required mega doses of vitamin D. Very good, Maggie.
He was imperfect.
And daily exposure to a sun lamp kept
it's
curbside.
From the Dark Knight.
It's from the Dark Knight, yeah. It's from the Joker.
He also had, this is really weird, but he also had hammer toes on his left foot.
It's just like a jammed toe. A hammer toe occurs from a muscle, this according to WebMD. Hammer toe occurs from a muscle and ligament imbalance around the toe joint, which causes the middle toe the middle joint of the toe to buckle and become stuck in this position. The most common complaint of hammer toes is rubbing and irritation on the top of the bent toe. Well,
irritated Charles Sr. That's for
some,
damn sure.
Let's get some pictures of hammer toe here.
Rebecca, I think, I don't know what else you have to say on Charles Lindbergh, okay. but the Web Crawlers girls have a lot to say
okay.
on Charles Lindbergh.
So everyone, we have this new segment that we're testing out where when we do a tragedy or a historical event that has been plagued with conspiracy theories, we go to our fellow conspiracy theories experts, the Web Crawler Girls.
Hello, I'm Allie Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Stetton.
From the Web Crawlers podcast on Erios.
Hi.
We are your resident conspiracy theorists.
We are the conspiracy pros.
Experts. Melissa, you have some ideas about what happened with the Lindbergh baby.
Okay, this is a whole thing. Okay, so first of all, this is not a kidnapping. This is a straight up murder.
Shit. Continue.
So we need to look for a murderer.
Okay.
And I don't think we need to look far at all because I'm talking about patient zero, Charles Lindbergh himself.
Oh, you think this is like a JonBenet Ramsey kind of thing?
Yes, in a way. So first of all, this Charles Lindbergh guy, every biography of him treats him as if he were like this like international hero.
What was he like an aviation person?
He flew across the Atlantic in 33 hours.
Who among us has not?
He was the first to do it, and he won like $25,000.
And boy, are his arms tired.
And so he was also awarded the Medal of Honor, which is like the highest, blah, 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 blah. But he was just this basic bitch pilot.
Right.
He wasn't anything special.
Yeah, who cares?
He was like a mechanic. And, you know, if it wasn't him to fly across the ocean, it'd be some other bitch pilot.
Yeah.
So he just, there's nothing special about him. He just beat the competition.
Right.
And so I read a quote from his friend's wife. She said, "He's no more than a mechanic. If it hadn't been for this flight across the Atlantic, he would be running a gas station in St. Louis."
Ooh.
Yeah, burn. So I don't think he's a very smart guy. He even took his pregnant wife on a plane with an open cockpit at super high altitude, which you're not supposed to do with pregnant women. And so she had to be hospitalized for 4 days.
Was that when she was pregnant with the Lindbergh baby?
Yes.
Okay, okay, okay.
And because of this, their baby was born with an unusual, a large head, and it had rickets.
Oh.
And developmental issues are rumored.
Yes.
So
okay.
This goes into, so Charles Lindbergh, he also liked to play pranks on his wife by hiding the baby in closets. Who does that to a newborn baby? He's an idiot.
Also, I hate pranks. Yes. I had a boyfriend once who played pranks on me, and I was like, this isn't fun for anyone but you.
Who's pranking a new mom by hiding a newborn baby?
Yeah, the first prank was, I'm going to take you up in an airplane while you're pregnant so our baby comes out.
It was like a two-week trip. She was like up in the air in this high altitude.
For 2 weeks?
Not 2 weeks straight, because I think they had to like, you know, refuel the plane. But she was up there for 2 weeks.
Okay.
And so on the night when his baby went missing, he found a ransom note. But he didn't open the ransom note until the police got to the house.
Suspicious.
Who is not, like, your baby's missing, you see a ransom note, you're not just going to tear it up and be like, what the fuck does this say?
You open that immediately.
They're like, wait till the police gets here. And it's like,
no.
But then the thing that really, I just thought was crazy, is that when they found the baby's remains, it couldn't be easily identified because it had been a while.
Right.
But Charles was like, yeah, that's probably him. Let's cremate him immediately. Not even consulting with his wife, like, oh, should we have a funeral? Oh, whatever. He's like, no, that's him. Just cremate him.
This poor wife.
Yeah. So I think he was destroying evidence.
Yes, clearly.
And so I think Charles killed him because I think the baby had developmental issues.
And maybe he felt guilty for it or frustrated for
it. He was ashamed of it.
Yes.
Also, a weird thing that I realized, that the photos that they had in the press of the baby were all of the baby when it was younger than one. And the baby was 21 months old when it was kidnapped.
There's also some interesting stuff on Reddit if you look up the Lindbergh baby. Some say that the Lindbergh baby was actually never murdered, that it's a cover-up, and that the Lindbergh baby actually was sent to an asylum.
Oh.
some sort of like mental asylum or something to be raised there. But there was such a huge stigma at the time for sending your child away that they staged this kidnapping murder instead. Mm-hmm. There's also something weird that I've just discovered, which I don't fully understand, that the Lindbergh baby is part of the Mandela effect. If you don't know about the Mandela effect, which you probably do, it's that the cultural consciousness remembers things differently than how they actually are. Mm-hmm. So, for example, there's the Berenstain versus Berenstain Bears controversy, that the Berenstain Bears, which is how most people remember it, it's actually the Berenstain Bears.
Insane.
Yeah.
I still think it's...
It's spelled S-T-A-I-N, not Stein.
Yep.
So people say that the Lindbergh baby is part of the Mandela effect because it's been featured in shows like The Simpsons and Family Guy with the Lindbergh baby still being alive.
Okay, that makes sense to me because when I was reading about this, I was like, oh, yeah, it died.
Yeah.
Like, I remember it just being, like, it got kidnapped.
Right. So I guess the cultural consciousness is that we remember the Lindbergh baby being kidnapped and then found.
Yeah. Or, like, missing or, like,
yes.
People come forward and they're like, I'm the Lindbergh baby.
Yeah. Right. That's what us web crawlers have to say about the Lindbergh baby. If you want to listen to our podcast, you can tune into Web Crawlers on Earios, iTunes, Spotify.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone, I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Well, they bring up some interesting points. I mean, I don't think that the Lindbergh baby is alive, but...
No, I think it was a horrible child murdered.
I think it's definitely dead. But the fact that that Lindbergh cremated the child right away as if to do away with any evidence, and the... Melissa was talking about him playing pranks.
That, to me, is... That was, yeah. That, to sketch. Me, is very indicative of his character.
Yes.
As a... bad boy. Bad boy. Not in a good way, in a nasty way. He's a nasty person.
Nasty boy.
And that's indicates something broken about him.
Right.
And he had the eugenics thing and the affairs he had with other women to try to like father a superhuman baby. And
then on top of that, he tried to cover the grossest part to me about it is like, if you're going to be a bad boy, then be a bad boy. Right.
Right.
But don't pretend to not be a bad boy. He's going up on the board.
He's up on the board. I don't know if he orchestrated it. Often I tend to go with Occam's razor. Simplest is probably the most accurate. I don't know about the huge conspiracy, if there was a huge conspiracy, but we know that people were really dumb. And like, there were footprints and he that got trampled over by police. They didn't measure them. And like, who knows about the evidence got kind of destroyed in the process between when the baby was found missing to, you know.
Apparently they allowed the reporters who showed up to just, and the people from the town to just come inside.
Right.
Before they even took the evidence.
Could the police did or the Lindberghs did?
The
Lindberghs. I thought he took control.
Oh, you're right.
I think
you're
it was
right.
them.
Because
was...
he wanted, because it added to his fame.
I mean.
He knew that his fame was diminishing. It was the, it was.
Well, he went on to live, he did kind of live out of the spotlight after this.
So you're saying like he didn't actually want
the
spotlight.
I don't know.
Well,
I'm not coming down decisively either way. But he was a shitty person.
He definitely was.
A really shitty person.
Okay, next person I want to put up on the board because we have a lot to get through is John Condon.
That guy's weird too.
So sketch.
What a weird dude.
Intermediary.
So my whole question is like, why would the kidnappers choose only to communicate through Condon, right?
Get a cut?
Well, exactly.
Right.
It seems very unusual that they would just trust a person who wrote into a local newspaper.
Right.
And there's a professor of Rutgers, Gardner, the same guy. He believes that Condon had been contacted beforehand and told to write mm-hmm. into the newspaper. And not just that, but it's the Depression. It's 1932. What kind of retired school teacher has $1,000 lying around that they can just add?
Great point.
To
do we know what he taught?
He taught in a university. I don't know what he taught. Chris?
Geography? Alchemy?
The easily distracted fact checker will check.
So,
John Condon.
Condon, I don't like his style. I don't like him like getting involved. He seems like a fame seeker.
Could he have been involved? I mean, you could convince me of that.
And actually, he did become suspect. And on top of that, he was the only person who could identify Bruno. The only other thing is that a few other people who got the gold certificates did testify that it was Bruno that they had seen. Or some said it was a German man.
Bruno seems involved.
Now I want to talk about Violet Sharp. Violet Sharp, it works in the house of the Lindberghs as a waitress, I believe. And she's under investigation by authorities. And she gets questioned multiple times. And before the fourth time she gets questioned, she commits suicide by swallowing poison. I believe it was a silver polish that contained cyanide.
Yeah.
And she swallows
brutal.
It.
Brutal.
Terrible. And she had been carefully checked, and it was soon ascertained that she had no connection to the abduction. So either she later on, they were like, you know, her alibi, it pans out. And also we think that it was just the stress of feeling like she was going to lose her job. And
it was the depression
and the question, you know, being questioned by the police that drew her to commit suicide.
Herself?
Yeah.
Drinking poison.
Or was she involved?
Right.
I'll put her on the board.
The other thing is like what was was probably extremely stressful because even though if she did have a clear conscience, if she was innocent, there was so much speculation that she probably, I mean, she could have been under that kind of stress and pressure that like, well, what if they turn to me? Like, what the heck
what am I going to do?
What am I going to do? You know?
I mean, it's a
who cleared
good question.
Her? How did she get cleared?
After she was dead. The police.
Who we trust.
Not
implicitly. Is it plausible that Violet Sharp was the one who told where the baby would be?
Ooh.
Oh.
She tipped him off.
Off?
Well, the baby was found by truck drivers.
I mean, where the baby that they were staying at this house as opposed to in the city, which room it was in.
Because I see.
The baby was taken from a second, it is possible. The second story.
Yeah, I mean, it is possible.
Bedrooms.
And they weren't even supposed to be in that house. They were supposed to be in the city that night.
Oh, right. That makes sense. So she could have been just a go-between to be like, give me a little something-something and just, I'll tell you where the baby is. Don't hurt the baby, maybe.
Yeah.
Sure.
We'll never know.
We'll never know.
But we're putting her up on the board. Yeah. That's for sure. There are a few other things I want to talk about.
Let's talk about it.
The public spectacle.
Uh-huh.
Could that be to blame?
Public spectacle, I mean, can we be more specific there and say the press?
We can.
Can we say the yellow press?
I don't, what do you mean about the yellow press?
Yellow journalism, sensationalism.
Oh, sensationalism. Yes, I'm always hesitant about blaming the media.
So one thing I know about Rebecca, she will not blame the media.
But I do think that for this, they really screwed up a lot for the case. Number one, they literally ruined evidence.
Right.
Number two, they were manipulative in the sense of the Hearst company, you know, paying for the defense lawyer. Number three, they really made it difficult to focus on the right leads. Mm. So, you know, there were literally thousands of leads that came in. And look, that is, any high profile case, that's going to happen. There are going to be a lot of people who call in. But this was
also putting Lindbergh in the spotlight in the beginning, making him a target.
What do you mean making him a target?
Well, just that because he was a tabloid darling.
Right.
That it made him more vulnerable to
exploitation. Mean beforehand.
Before the baby was kidnapped, yeah.
And also after, in the sense that he was never even considered a potential what do you call it? Suspect, because he's such a darling, and he's how could that a celebrity of
not
that
a handsome
status,
white man
no.
be a well, criminal?
We talk about this with a preppy murder. I mean, this is like this happens all the time.
Yeah. Like imagine someone seeing like Clooney killed a baby.
I wouldn't believe it.
I'd say get out of my damn house, you fool.
I was listening to a podcast where they were saying like there's no way we can comprehend how huge Lindbergh was, because there's no one that compares.
Right.
Because there was only one, everyone was reading the one paper.
Right. And also like think of like aviation and like a plane.
Yeah.
It's like God. It's magic. So the media's up there, and I feel good about it.
Okay.
I also want to put up the Great Depression / gangster culture.
Tell me more.
Okay. So the era that, you know, the 1930s saw 300 kidnappings a year.
And
kidnappings
desperate
were becoming
people.
More common leading up to the kidnapping of the Lindbergh baby. And some say that it was a systemic, some saw it as a systemic problem of 1932. Mm. Now, a book, Trials of the Century, Mark J. Phillips, Aaron Z. Phillips, says, the stock market crash and following depression had made violence and means of economic survival and had ushered in a wave of gangs, bootleggers, and professional criminals. Kidnapping for ransom was an effective method of criminals to profit from wealthy Americans like the Lindberghs. Mm-hmm. It had become a remarkably organized business. I just think that this was
a desperate time.
Yeah, and it was more common than we might think.
Right.
And let's face it, this is happening in some countries.
Absolutely.
Like, it happens in Venezuela. It happens in Mexico all the time. It happens in, you know, it's common practice.
Right.
This is how the literally.
However, that's kidnapping, not murder. This baby was murder.
I think there's a point in saying that it's potentially was a murder by mistake.
Yes.
Because, again, the latter was broken.
Right.
Right?
Baby could have fallen or something.
The baby could have fallen. It was a very narrow window.
Yeah.
Imagine carrying a baby off, like, from the second story on a homemade ladder. Right. It's not even, like, a sturdy thing.
So what you're saying is we might want to put bad craftsmanship up on the board, huh?
100% I want to put that up.
Okay, I'll just put ladders. You know, when you think about it, though, is any kid, does any kidnapper get away with it unless they, like, if you return the baby or the kidnapped person, there's no way of getting away with it in America.
So my next thing that I was thinking about putting up on the board are the U.S. laws against kidnapping at the time.
Right. What were they?
Laws against kidnapping were highly inconsistent in the U.S. In New Jersey, for example, it was punishable by 30 years. But in New York, a convicted kidnapper only faced 5 to 15 years. The ease and availability of transportation made it common practice for kidnappers to jump state lines, yet the crimes still, yet the crime was still not a federal offense, and the state police could not arrest a suspected kidnapper in the state in which the crime was committed. So that just made it easily accessible.
Okay.
It just made kidnapping a little bit easier.
Right. More of a viable option.
Viable option for desperate people.
Right.
Viable option for desperate people.
So why don't we start really taking a look at what we have up on the board and crossing things off. Now, for our listeners, this is what's up on the board. Maria, will you hit us?
Bruno Hauptmann, Isidore Fish, Charles Lindbergh, John Condon, Violet Sharp, The Media, Gangster Culture, Ladders or Bad Craftsmanship, Kidnapping Laws of the Time.
Okay. Now, is there anything off the bat that we think we can take off?
Hauptmann.
Whoa.
Hauptmann?
I'm kidding.
I think Gangster Hauptmann. Culture can go because to me, Gangster Culture is... less about it didn't seem like this was retaliation.
Right.
Gangster culture is like, we're going to do crime and then we're going to get rid of anybody who gets in the way of our crime.
Yes.
And this feels different than that.
Okay. So gangster culture is, I agree with that. Okay. So that's off. I think we can take the media off.
I do think media sets the scene and sets the tone for what people think that they can get away with and was used as a tool the whole time.
And in all fairness, he was so famous because of the media.
That's what I was going to say, is that the only reason that this guy, his son was a target was that people knew about him. People right. knew he had money because of this stupid trip. And Melissa was saying in that conspiracy theory yes. segment, He was a mechanic. He was a dude.
He was a basic bitch pilot.
He was a basic bitch pilot. Somebody else was going to do it if it wasn't Charles Lindbergh. So, what is his... why is he exceptional?
He's not.
He's only exceptional because the media said he was exceptional. And so, I don't know. I'd like to stay in at least longer than
I kind of agree.
You know what's also crazy, though, too, is that everything was going on through these newspapers when it could have been done privately.
Yes. Was the media helping or were they actually making it worse by all the sensationalism that
you know, I think that goes back to Charles Lindbergh, who I am very, I think is a good candidate for alarmist jail. He was the one who took control of the investigation. He basically kicked out the police. So they used the media because they could have gone through the cops, but he didn't want to go through the cops.
Yeah. Right.
He could have turned it over to the FBI, but he didn't want to do that. He wanted to do it himself or, you know, be involved in this, super way. And either it's for nefarious reasons or for ego. It's for his own ego. So, I mean, I think that the media was just kind of a very,
useful tool for him.
Eager participant.
Yeah.
But was only able to do what they were able to do because of what he allowed.
I wish we knew more about Violet Sharp because
I know everything about her. I really do think that no one's killing themselves because they're being questioned. Someone's killing themselves because they did something that they regret. And they didn't know it was going to go down the way it went down.
Yeah, and if the kidnappers didn't have the information that she would have provided, yes. That insider info, then maybe this wouldn't have happened.
I have some room in that alarmist jail.
I have a feeling you might get a couple new inmates. No, I'm not saying she's responsible for it, but I am saying I am suspecting that she was told, we will give you money if you tell us where the baby is, the baby will be unharmed.
Yeah.
And it will be returned once we get the ransom, and you'll get a cut of that secretly.
I can't disagree.
It could have even been more innocent than that, of just like, hey, pretty lady, can I buy you a few drinks? So you work at that Lindbergh house, right? Where do I keep that baby?
That's right.
Where do I keep that? Oh, I talked to this nice man. His name was Fishy Fish. Yeah. And he just was so complimentary of my hat or whatever
it was.
I mean, it could be innocent, more innocent, but...
Well, why don't we take out kidnapping laws? Because I don't think that that could be to blame.
Okay. No, I mean, I think...
I think it made it easier. I made it more appealing.
Look, a guy who spells good, G-U-T, is not really going to know about the ins and outs of... laws.
I think we can take away Isidore Fish. I think he's involved. I think he might be. But I also think that there's no way to really pin him down. We don't have the...
We don't have enough.
We don't have enough there.
Too circumstantial.
So I feel good taking him off.
What about John Condon?
No, I don't think it was him.
I think he maybe got involved after.
After?
Yeah, after the kidnapping.
And he was like, give me a cut, I'll help you out.
Yeah, I think there was some kind of like...
I see.
But I don't think,
he conceived of it.
No.
Just an opportunist.
I think he feels like an opportunist, yeah. Bye, John. So we've got Bruno, we've got Lindbergh himself, Violet Sharp, the media, and Ladders. Let's talk about Ladders.
Well, there's also the metaphorical ladder of ladder climbing.
Oh my God. Wow.
Tell me.
And that Lindbergh wanted to, you could call him Icarus, flew too close to the sun, got too rich, got too big for his britches, made himself real vulnerable, and in doing so, opened up his family to horrible tragedy. So I think that that's a metaphorical ladder. And also that Bruno Hauptmann was looking for a quick buck, was looking for some money, and wanted to, wanted to climb the, pull himself up by his bootstraps, even if that meant... horrible murder.
Uh-huh. But we're not blaming a ladder for the kidnapping.
Why not?
That's not of all
is
the
Is that
people.
In the rules? Okay. Are we going to get kicked off the Erios network if we blame a ladder?
And so the Lindbergh baby was kidnapped because of a ladder.
Well, it was the means.
Hey, it'd make a great headline.
Ladder kidnaps baby.
Okay, fine. Ladder's gone.
Should we take off Violet?
Yeah. I think we can take Violet.
Yeah, poor Violet.
All right, so we have Bruno Hauptmann, Charles Lindbergh, and the media.
Okay. I have a feeling.
What's your feeling?
I think we should put Mr. Lindbergh in the alarmist jail. Do you think that's victim blaming?
I think Bruno Hauptmann is involved. I think that he should not escape alarmist jail. So I think that... can it be a double conviction?
Well... I mean, if two people do the crime...
Then two people do the time?
I think we should put Bruno in the alarmist jail and then force Charles to go visit him every single week.
No.
Or you want to put on probation? You want to put Charles on probation?
No, I want Charles to suffer.
House arrest. Put him back in his mansion.
Yeah. House arrest is too
plain
good
arrest.
For Charles.
Plain arrest. He's got to fly... Oh, he's got to fly back and forth from New York to Paris, and he only gets a break to pee and for the gas to get filled.
Well, that's it. And he has to eat airplane food for the rest of his life.
Or we put him in a closet. Because that's how he ranked his big prankster wife. Yeah.
Bruno Hauptmann, you're going to the alarmist jail. Charles Lindbergh, you're on plane arrest. Well, thank you, Maggie. This was a doozy, and I feel like the crime fits the time.
That's a long one.
After the kidnapping, public outrage led the U.S. Congress to pass the Federal Kidnapping Act, known as the Lindbergh Law. The Lindbergh Law made kidnapping across state lines a federal crime and stipulated that such an offense could be punished by death.
Lindbergh, his name will live in history. Over the ocean he flew all alone, gambling with
you think is to blame by going to thealarmistpodcast.com. Follow us at The Alarmist The on Twitter, at The Alarmist Podcast on Instagram, or email us at thealarmistpodcast@gmail.com. Next week, we'll be tackling Chernobyl.
Eerios.
Powered by Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.